Hello, everyone, and welcome to Facebook Live. Today is Monday, July 12th, and we're here with Dr. Brendan Hanley, the Chief Medical Officer of Health for UConn. Welcome, Dr. Hanley.
Thank you.
I want to give a few messages, a shout out to all the UConners and the Canadian military that's been out helping sandbag and protect all the houses. I know we're in a state of emergency in the Southern Lakes area. There's lots of family and friends out at Lake LaBarge who are experiencing loss and the stress of having to protect your home from Mother Nature. And I know our fire crews are out there fighting fires as well. So it's a very tough time for all UConners. And we're in the midst of a wave of this pandemic. So that's our topic for today, is just giving an update on what's going on and answering your questions. And we've got quite a few of them. We have received quite a few in advance, and we've grouped some of them into themes, and we've combined some of the questions because we did receive quite a volume of questions. I do want to, I know we have experienced another loss in our First Nation community, another elder, and I want to express the condolences to the family, but just the importance of protecting our elders. And if you're an elder and you have not received your full vaccination yet, please get out there and get your vaccines. The health centers are there for you. And if you have an elder in your family, please assist them, talk to them about getting their vaccine. It's a hard loss for us to see our elders leaving our community, that level of wisdom and caring. So I think with that, I want to pass it over to you, Dr. Hanley, to give some opening remarks.
Yeah, thank you, Mathia. And first of all, just to echo what Mathia has just said, that we're all really saddened by another loss of an elder, and it really. I also want to add my condolences to the family and to the community as well. And you know, each loss that we face is a big hit for all of us, because we're all so closely connected in this small territory. So it is another sad time for us. Maybe a sad way to begin, but this is the reality that we're in now, we are in a period of struggle. But we also know what to do, and we know we're going to be talking a lot about those various aspects of the response and next steps as we go. So I'm very pleased to be here.
Thank you. I know the press update hasn't happened yet. Could you give us an update on where we're at with our latest cases?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I can... certainly in terms of trends, I mean, we will be publishing the updated case counts, and I don't, you know, even have those counts confirmed. That is part of our normal process of getting all the up-to-date information and verifying the count and then putting that, posting that. And so we will post that for the press release today. So, you know, as of the end of Friday, we were at 116 active cases in UConn. So I anticipate that number will be a little bit lower. What we've been seeing day to day is a little bit of a drop in our numbers of active cases, and then new cases, about 6 to 10 new cases a day. But we have so many people recovering that the number of recoveries is actually greater than the number of new cases at the moment. And so that's good. I mean, it shows that we're in a more stable pattern right now. Of that, the kind of 6 to 10 daily cases a day, and almost exclusively now within our Whitehorse-based urban population. That's certainly the vast majority of cases are adults now, and connected in some way to that kind of downtown housing unstable population. that are really centered around downtown Whitehorse, and connect people connected in one way or another into that community. Many of the new cases are contacts and known contacts or household contacts of people that have already been identified as cases. There have been a few rural cases, and we'll probably talk a little bit more about that in general, but pretty low numbers. And really, we've also moved away from daycare associated cases, the earlier school associated, or that school age associated cases. So moving more into that adult population now. So that would be the trend, and then the actual numbers will be confirmed later today.
Mm-hmm. Could you highlight the, I know we're posting the percentages now, highlight the difference in the cases between vaccinated, unvaccinated, and partially?
Yeah, this is a really important and actually also a fairly complicated situation to explain, but I will certainly try. So the vast majority of our cases are in unvaccinated individuals. And currently the percentage, if we look at the pure percentage of cases that are unvaccinated, it's 80%. And if we add in the partially vaccinated, it's another 7 or 8%. So about 11 or 12% of our cases, and that might change today, are actually occurring in fully vaccinated individuals. Now that is actually expected that we will, when you have a lot of COVID activity in the community, so a lot of opportunity to get infected. And you have a lot of adults who are fully vaccinated, which is a good thing. It means that even fully vaccinated individuals will be getting exposed to the virus, and some of them then will get infected. The vast majority of people who are fully vaccinated and get infected with COVID do very well. They have nothing more than mild symptoms. Every now and then, though, we will see someone get sicker. And that's either because they may be elderly, they may have underlying medical conditions, it may be for one reason or another that the vaccine didn't take effect as much as it usually does. Keeping in mind that when we talk about a 90 to 95% effective vaccine, that means that 5% of the time or so, it doesn't work as well. And that could be for a variety of reasons. But you could also think of this as a 95% protection. So we're seeing 95% less consequence of infection or less complications of infection because when people are fully vaccinated. So you see a few, but the vast majority of this outbreak is affecting unvaccinated people. And when we look at serious outcomes, the vast majority of serious outcomes are amongst people who are unvaccinated, a few who are partially vaccinated. So this is really a picture of the virus looking for susceptible people. This virus, you know, if we were to make it into a human, it would be like some evil creature looking for unvaccinated people. But that's what it is, looking for opportunities for infection. And the easiest target is the unvaccinated person who then can spread it onto others. So we're seeing it work its way through networks of unvaccinated people. And then occasionally, even someone who's fully vaccinated, who's standing in the way, gets hit. But the vast majority of times, the fully vaccinated people actually do very well.
Mm-hmm. There was a question about herd immunity, and is this something we're still striving for? I know we're one of the highest vaccinated populations in Canada, and now we have the highest percentage per capita. And I think you touched on this in other meetings before, but what was the seed of this outbreak and what caused it to spread? And are we still trying to seek herd immunity?
Yeah. Okay, so we'll go back, because that's lots of questions in one. So I'm going to try and address those one at a time. But if we go back and think how did this begin? So, and at the time that this really started to take off, we were in a position where we had, I think it was 72% of our adults, 18 plus, fully vaccinated. And then it was like 80 some percent of adults who were partially vaccinated, who had had their first dose. And we were also just at the time where the youth were starting to get their vaccines. So they were kind of just into that first dose of vaccine. Now, of course, we're in an even better position that we have, I think it's 76% last time I looked of adults fully vaccinated. The youth are really climbing up fast. So we're really at approaching, if we're not there already, that 75% 12 plus population. Very, very good position in terms of vaccine status. But what we are seeing is that we have, if you put together, especially include youth and children the young children who don't yet have the opportunity to get vaccinated, and then you add that onto the unvaccinated adults, you're still talking about 10 to 12,000 people. So that, if you think of that as a pool of susceptible people to COVID infection, all you need is the spark of introduction into that, and then people gathering enough that you can actually then allow significant transmission to occur. So again, back into those sort of early days of June, late days of May, or even from the middle of May, we know that there were a number of circumstances happening. One is we were talking about opening up. And of course, on May 25th, we did through Yukon government, put in place some opening measures around gatherings. And that was also when the fully vaccinated adults no longer had to quarantine. But even leading up to that, there was a sense that we're getting into summer, we're doing really well, we're going to be opening up. And of course, and that those are the conversations we should be and needed to have, because we have to move away from a lockdown or this whole set of restrictions eventually. But I think there was this feeling that we were done, that we didn't have to do anything anymore, that we didn't have to worry about distancing or mask use maintaining that all of the measures that we're still keeping in place. So I think people just really relaxed and forgot about COVID. And thus we had right around that mid-May, people closely gathering who were not who probably should not have been gathering so closely in big numbers. So we had house parties, bush parties, we had people drinking together, and I think what happened is that there was some introduction of COVID from out of territory one way or another. Mixing with those gatherings, it just started to amplify, and people didn't really understand or detect what was going on. We probably had a couple of cycles of transmission when people probably had mostly mild symptoms, didn't pay much attention to them, maybe went to work, maybe were going to other gatherings, and you had this undetected kind of growing wave of infection. And that suddenly became noticed when a couple of people started to get sick. And so we remember we had those early at the onset of this wave, we had three people sick enough to be hospitalized. We had cases in the mine. And that was really the already there had been substantial transmission amongst a lot of people that resulted in that wave, you know, the big spikes in numbers that we saw. And meanwhile, that the infection had been seeded back into most communities. People were in Whitehorse for the First Nation grad and associated events, as well as other reasons for being here, and were in contact with COVID, got infected unknowingly, and carried it back unknowingly into communities. And so that's where we really saw wide dispersal over a short time. So that's kind of the story of how it all began, and recognizing also that this is a P1 event, so the gamma variant, and that the variant, as all variants, are much more transmissible. So even a year ago, when we didn't have vaccines, and with the former COVID, the wild type COVID, it probably would not have spread so much because it wasn't as good at spreading as it is now. But now we have a highly transmissible virus that really is taking any opportunity given, it will take that opportunity and spread quickly amongst those unvaccinated networks of people. So there's more questions to answer, but I'm going to take a breath and just see if you want me to clarify anything, Matthew, or shall I go on to the question of herd immunity? And you're muted right now.
Rookie. That piece about the importance of the gamma variant and how easily it spreads, and what we're seeing, we are kind of lucky that we're not getting that Delta variant that's spreading through the states and throughout Southern Canada. I'm sure we're going to expect that here soon. What measures or what additional risk does that pose for Yukon populations?
So that is a great question, and we need to learn everything we can from what's happening right now and apply it to how we manage the risk of introduction of Delta, because we will get introduction of Delta variant, we will see other variants introduced into Yukon with time. So we have to get better at doing this. We do know that whatever variant we're speaking of so far, that vaccine is still our biggest protection against incursions and spread. So the more, the more we have people vaccinated, including our elders, our youth, our young adults who can spread more easily, who will spread more easily because they do tend to gather more. So we need vaccination. And it gets back to that question of herd immunity. What is it that we need for herd immunity? I can tell you what we probably need is we probably need 100% vaccination. What can we realistically achieve? I think that remains to be seen. I think we should be shooting for in any eligible population that we get to, and soon we do now have 12 plus. We may have opportunities in the next few months to get to younger children. That's a whole other question, and we can come back to that question. But for now, I think we should think of 12 plus 95% is what we should be starting to aim for, because it's the more people vaccinated, the less opportunity to spread from one person to another, but also the smaller the pool of susceptible people. So we have people now getting people, beloved Yukoners, getting very sick from COVID. And none of us want to see that. So the more that we can convince people to get vaccinated, the better we'll do. And we need to really learn from what we're seeing, the impact. I think the impact of what we're seeing now would be actually very similar to a Delta, except the Delta might be just even more transmissible than the present variant that we have now.
Mm-hmm. That's so important. The vaccination rates amongst each age cohort, and that is now being shared, right, on the UConn.ca, the vaccination rates per age category, like the 12 to 17, and then
yes,
like 10, 15 year gaps. There was this question around the virus in communities, and what are we doing to ask all Yukoners to stay safe? But the underlying question there was around the recommendations versus changing the orders for SEMA So why are we offering strong recommendations and not changing the orders around isolation and mandatory shutdown? I know that's the knee-jerk reaction, is to have it, let's shut it down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's probably several layers of answers I can give to that. So the first, I think the first one is to be clear, is that we are presently under a Civil Emergency Measures Act. So that is an act that is overseen by the Minister of Community Services and ultimately by Cabinet and the Premier. So my recommend, apart from whatever I say to the public, and of course I talk to the public a lot and give my personal recommendations to the public as to what to do, but I also make recommendations to the government, and the decision making is actually under CIMA, is actually government's decision. It is not up to me to make orders under CIMA. So I think it's important to establish what the authorities are. It's also, I think, important to note, and you touched upon that, Mathia, it's that there might be that reactive, you know, go back into lockdown because we're getting overwhelmed. And I think we have to be much more savvy at how we respond, because we clearly have potential damage, and we have seen damage from lockdown measures. It also really doesn't make sense to go into lockdown when you have 75% or more of your adults fully vaccinated. So the whole paradigm of lockdown has changed dramatically since how we may have responded 7 months or 8 months ago to the same thing. Of course, in November, we averted by getting on top of an outbreak early we were in a different point of restrictions. But we did make some very targeted recommendations at this time. My recommended approach has always been to target the response to where you're seeing the risk, and really to focus on that, so that then you preserve people's mental health, you preserve the ability to go to school, to go to daycare, for people to go to work, for society to carry on, because that is a huge thing to try to keep going, is to keep us all going for our well-being and for our ability to live well and to thrive and to address our other health needs. So we always need to think about what is the right move for where we are right now and where is the risk. And really, the focus, from my point of view, based on what we are seeing, is let's get our contacts small. Let's concentrate on gatherings, and do that in the most effective way that we can. And that's why really kind of early and prompt orders around gatherings. And then, of course, the daycare, because we were seeing risk in daycare and exposures in daycare and even an outbreak in daycare, we really wanted to thin that out for a temporary period and allow the daycares to kind of catch up. And recognizing that many staff are off sick, but really it is focusing our response on where we are seeing the highest risk of transmission, and that is really why we decided, why I made the recommendations to government to really focus this on gatherings. We came up with that language about sticking to six, keeping contacts small. And I must say, I think it's working. I think what we're seeing is this is why we are now seeing that stabilization. We've seen this now concentrate in spread within the defined population, mostly. And we are using our, you know, case investigation and contact tracing and isolation and all of the social supports to keep that under control and eventually, see it through to burning out, which is what, of course, we all want to achieve.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the important pieces that I want to highlight around your recommendations to keep your gathering sizes to six, or your social gatherings to six, is not six of friends tonight and then another six friends tomorrow night and then another six friends the night after that. You had said something about keeping it to the same six, or trying to keep it as close to the same six as possible. And hopefully that that recommendation is getting through.
Yeah, and I will say we're not, I think it's somewhere in between the two, because I think we also need to move, and we have, you'll notice we've moved away from that sort of just stick to your bubble language, which we had before. And I think it's the language that we want now is to be very aware of who your contacts are and to keep them small. And six is a good number to think of. So if you're continually, partying with six people one night after the other and they're all different people, that's not really what we want to see. But it's okay to have flexibility into who those six people are if you're keeping your contacts small. And of course, the more that group of six is vaccinated, then the safer you're going to be as well.
Mm-hmm. I think we didn't touch on it, but that piece around individuals who are vaccinated, even if they contract it, they're not shedding as much virus, so they're not as transmissible. So your risk does reduce with that.
That's right. So we do know, and the studies still are incomplete, but we do have enough information to suggest that if you get infected and you're fully vaccinated, your chances of passing it on to someone else are much less, and maybe half as much, and maybe even less than that. We don't really know, but it really probably cuts your chance of passing it on to someone else. It cuts that in half, maybe more. We'll see when more studies come through. There aren't that many people to study, because the number of people who get infected, of course, is not very high. So it does take a while to get those studies done.
Yeah. And of course, UConn with our high vaccination rate and our 12 to 16% that have contracted COVID that are fully vaccinated get to be the test subjects for something like that. I wanted to touch on this other question around what sort of symptoms were you seeing in young people?
Our young people have done very well. And again, we know that this is what happens in the rest of the world, and this is playing out in UConn as well. So mm-hmm. all of our young people, and we've had some very young people, even less than a year old. And again, we had some of those cases associated with daycare. We had earlier on a lot of youth that were associated with those early grad events. And they've, right up into the teenage years, they've all done very well in terms of just mild symptoms. So we do know that children play with variants. Children play more of a role in transmitting to others, but we know that the outcomes are very, very good. And serious outcomes in children are very rare. They can happen. And again, we want to prevent hundreds and thousands of people from getting infected. But we do know that that kids do really well when they get COVID infection.
Mm-hmm. So they fare really well, but they are transmitting, please get vaccinated if you have small children who can't get vaccinated. I know this is all like the number of hospitalizations and this additional testing, all of it is taxing our territory's health system. There was a request from UConn government for additional supports from the federal government. And could you touch on the healthcare side of that aspect or that request?
Yeah, for sure. This is important. And again, I think it's part of our learnings about how much can we withstand if we get further situations like this, and how do we build in that surge support when we need it. We did, first of all, and you saw how this disease works its way through, so that the first system to get slammed was the public health system. And then you saw the effects later on the acute care system. So what happens is, of course, suddenly we start to see, over a short period of time, we see a few cases a day that then go into like 10 cases a day, and then 15 and 20s. And then, of course, we were up into the high 20s of cases per day for a while, with major spikes, then a little bit of a downslope, and then major spikes again. So that, when you think about the effect on the public the public health system in terms of the staff at YCDC, the community nurses in the communities, dealing with now dozens and eventually hundreds of cases, and then hundreds and hundreds of contacts that are all being kind of directed into self-isolation and somehow managed and followed up. So you can just see how the nurses and the providers there got completely slammed, and we were looking early on for extra people extra people to help with that contact tracing. And then about a week later, because usually if people are going to get sick from COVID, and we know, again, the majority of people do well, you know, even adults and middle age and older, the majority do well, and then a certain percentage get sick. And if they do get sick, it's more into the second week of their infection. So then we see that kind of real surge on the hospitals of many people coming in sick, and either because they just need to be assessed, they may need some, you know, a physician assessment, and then they may be discharged, but they need that kind of medical assessment because they have new symptoms, or because they actually need to stay because they need hospital treatment, usually oxygen, sometimes intensive care. And as you know, we've had to send people out for intensive care down south. Or they have care because we're talking about many people who have other medical conditions. And when you have COVID, you may have other things going on that need attention or that get worse because of the COVID infection. So you also may have people who have addictions and who may be in alcohol withdrawal or drug associated problems that also need medical care, and they have to be hospitalized for a while as well. So lots of reasons to be hospitalized, and then a big crunch on hospital demand. And yeah, suddenly going from zero patients in hospital to as many as 12 to 14 patients in the hospital, all of who need COVID care, that needs lots of nursing support. They need special isolation. The environmental cleaning after takes a long time and uses up the rooms. It's a huge demand to the point of being overwhelmed, which is really the point where the hospital had to then cut back on some of the elective services in order to concentrate people on that acute care, the demand on the hospital, and that request for extra people as well.
So are we at that tipping point now where we're at max capacity for acute care, and we need to be shipping people to or medevacing people to Vancouver?
So the reason, I would say now we've gone through a peak and we're in a better place. Certainly if we look at the hospital today versus last week, it's in a much better position in terms of the number of patients with COVID. It's important to be clear that the people who have been medevaced out, they've been medevaced out because their individual medical condition has needed intensive care down south. So they've needed to be ventilated, basically. So they're really at that point of needing ventilation. And those are the ones that have gone south. It hasn't been purely because of that limited capacity. We normally, in any time, we don't take care of patients more than, say, a couple of days who need a ventilator. So if someone looks like they're only going to need like 24 hours of ventilation, that certainly is done within this hospital. But this hospital does not have a tertiary care, and you know, with intensive care specialists, with the intensive care nurses, with all of those supports and technology that is needed. And that's why at any time of year, those people are sent to hospitals like Vancouver General, St. Paul's, the hospitals in Calgary or Edmonton, for intensive care. And those are the individuals that have been sent out when they need potentially days or even weeks of ventilation to support them through their COVID illness.
Yeah. And how many do we have in ICU right now?
So we have sent a total of, and I think these will also be confirmed, but I believe the number of people sent south for intensive care has been 12 since June 1st.
Mm-hmm. And you probably don't have the updated number of how many we have there currently.
Currently down south, we have a couple that are preparing for discharge, but we will get all those numbers sorted out later on today.
Okay. I think this also highlights or is a good segue into that question around where people should get tested. If you have been tested and you know you have COVID and you are going to the hospital because your symptoms are worsening, then that's one scenario. But there's individuals who may be experiencing symptoms that are going to the hospital. Is that where they should be going to get tested, or maybe just address that scenario? So we're getting that on social media a lot, people going to the emergency for testing.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I think it's important that the emergency departments are there for people when they're feeling sick and when they feel they need medical help. They are there for you, and they will always be there for you. And that includes the health centers in the rural communities as well. So an example would be you're tested, you know you're positive, and you know you're a few days into your illness and you're starting to feel short of breath, or you're just feeling unwell, or you're feeling that your thinking's not straight. Those are times we really want that medical assessment to occur, and those are times we welcome you to go be seen in the emergency department. If you're worried about how well you're doing, or how well your partner is doing, or your mother or your father or someone else, that they need medical care, that's what we should be doing, and will be continue to do. If it's just that you're worried you might have COVID because you have, say, a sore throat and a headache, and you want to get tested, then the best place to get tested is in Whitehorse, is at the testing center. If you're feeling well, you don't have to be tested immediately. The important immediate step is to self-isolate. So make sure that you start to isolate away from others, and then look up the testing hours. And that could be the drive-in in the evening or the daytime at the SeaTac. There's also testing at the Kwanlundan Health Center, and there's also we have testing at the Whitehorse Emergency Shelter for those who are shelter users and residents, and of course we have testing in the rural community health centers. So those are really the places. I would not advise going to Emerge just to get tested. When we have the CTAC, it's much easier to book an appointment at the CTAC, and you'll be seen, you know, usually quite quickly, and then you'll get out of there quite quickly. It's a much better experience probably for you, because you avoid those long waits, and it also means that you're not, you know, adding to the demands on the emergency. But we do want people who are worried about how well they're doing and think they need to have a checkup or a to see a doctor, definitely the emergency is for you.
Thank you. And we'll post the link to the testing center hours and the contact numbers and everything in the chat so people can have that. Mm-hmm. I know we talked a little bit about the P1 variant and how it's spreading. We talked about the Delta, but on social media, we're getting quite a few questions about ivermectin. What is it, and can it be used to treat COVID-19?
This is a really interesting area, and I think one of the things to we need better treatments for COVID, and I really look forward to a future over the next months and years of having better treatments for COVID infection, including hopefully eventually the the idea of antivirals. Ivermectin is not a drug that is currently recommended for COVID. It has been promoted a lot. There's certainly a lot of media and advocacy for it, but there is no evidence so far that it plays a role in that, or that it improves. Ivermectin is actually a known anti-parasite drug used primarily in veterinary medicine. It really is
kind of an anti-worm agent for veterinary medicine. It has not been shown to play a role.
There are some medications that are used at different points in COVID care in hospital cases. So for instance, dexamethasone or steroid is often used now. There are some particular combinations of antivirals that are sometimes used depending on the severity of the case. We don't have any outpatient treatments. So if you're just, let's say you're 60 years old and you have COVID infection and you're at home, and you're doing okay, we don't have a sort of an antiviral or a medication for that scenario, not yet. And hopefully in the future we will, because we want to, if there were a way to prevent that person from getting worse or getting serious illness, that's something that would be a really valuable tool. And it's also, of course, why we go back to vaccination, because if we can prevent infection in the first place, then we're going to do better.
Mm-hmm. I think that brings up that question around boosters, and are you privy to some of the discussions around booster shots and where Canada's approval, Health Canada's approval is going with that?
Yeah, this is really another one of those evolving areas, and you have a whole array of different conversations. One is that the companies making applications for booster shots, including modified, newer vaccines from Pfizer and other companies down the line, that are actually going to be more adapted to variants. So we will be using booster shots almost for sure. The questions are more about when, and is it going to be different for different age groups and different populations? And that is where a lot of study and decision making still has to occur. So it's also, I think, the fundamental priority is to get as many people their first two doses of vaccine let's keep working away at the first two doses. And then when we have more evidence on duration of immunity, then we'll figure out when is the best timing to offer a booster. And it could be that the timing is different, say, for people who are elderly or in long-term care, than for young adults. You might have some that might be a year, and then the young people a couple of years. So there's going to be almost certainly variation, perhaps by where you live, and what the interval was between the first and the second dose, and what age group, and there's all kinds of questions that still to be hammered out. There's no hurry. We don't need to go into boosters right away. We've got time, and so far the studies show that there's good immunity post-vaccine, 6 months and likely beyond. So really our focus is on getting everyone possible the two doses.
Mm-hmm. And this is another kind of forward-looking. What does the timing look like for the vaccination of under 12?
Yeah, it's probably a matter of months still, and it's going to be a similar conversation. Like, there's one thing as at some point, and that may be September, October, I would think that we will get approval. And then the second question will be, well, do we recommend it or not, and at what's the timing that we recommend? So for it, and here's a kind of a real global equity piece that is really important for all of us to talk about. Is it more important to vaccinate our children who we know do very well? And if we have all of our adults vaccinated, then the effect on children is actually going to be quite small. Is it, what's more important, vaccinating our children or vaccinating as much of the world as possible so that the rest of the world has an opportunity to get protected from pandemics, but also that we decrease the risk of new variants occurring, which will then come back to haunt us. So those are the kind of balanced questions that we really need to have, because we ultimately want to be protecting the world from vaccine-resistant variants of the future. And those are the kind of questions that we really have to decide. So there's lots more to come on if and when we start to vaccinate the young children. And I think by the fall, we'll know a lot more about whether we should be going ahead and how.
Thank you for bringing up the global community, because we are, this virus is showing that our global community is quite small, and our variants, they may show up from another nation. They were called the Brazil variant or the UK variant previously. But it shows how quickly people travel the world and how this virus is a backpacker traveling through the world very quickly. Yes. So that's a good reminder about our global position. And Canadians have always been very good global citizens with our little flags on our backpacks or Canadian pins. I want to talk about those who have had the virus, and we hear about it a lot in media, especially in the US media, around COVID long haulers. Are we seeing any of that yet in the Yukon? And if we are, how are we supporting those individuals who may be COVID long haulers?
Yeah, so I think it's something, again, that we will, it's one of those areas that we will learn more as we go about what exactly it means, what's the exact, you know, who falls into that category, who doesn't, because there are definitely people who have, some people who have prolonged symptoms, even though, you know, most people get better within, say, 2 to 4 weeks and they're back to normal. There are others who have more prolonged symptoms. And then there are others who seem to have symptoms that just persist for months. And that's where it gets into that more sort of long COVID condition of feeling, say, fatigue, real lack of energy, just not feeling well, headaches, a number of symptoms. So of course we have a healthcare system, and people's needs can be addressed through our healthcare system. I think as we learn more about, are there specific treatments that would be more helpful than others? Because we're really not at that point yet. Then we might have more kind of specialized approaches for that. Have we seen any? I don't know of any that we've seen. We're still like really into that acute phase right now, when we've seen a lot of people infected in a short time. Will some people end up with long COVID out of those? I think it's quite possible. And I think we do have to as a kind of a healthcare system, learn as much as we can about how we detect and how we follow people, and make sure that those people, as we get more information and and evidence about what the best approach is, that we integrate that into our healthcare system as well.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. I want to ask one last question about the vaccine. We do have quite a few Yukoners who don't believe that the vaccine is safe, or that they're concerned about the ingredients that are in the vaccine. Can you touch on how safety is monitored and what Yukoners should do if they experience side effects?
Yeah, for sure. So there is a very strong, and Canada's lucky because we've always had a strong system for monitoring adverse effects of vaccines and a reporting system to make sure that symptoms that appear to be associated with the vaccine are reported and then assessed locally here and then reported on up. So we have what was called an adverse events reporting system. So let's say you have a vaccine and then something weird happens 2 or 3 days later, and you might think, this is not, you know, this is not something that I usually feel, and I wonder if it's the vaccine. You can always report that back to the health center where you received the vaccine. And then that will be assessed. You may get some questions asked. You may, in some cases this has happened, be asked to have a medical assessment done. So then, let's say it's a rash or pain somewhere or swelling or a lymph node or something like that, then that might be medically assessed. And then it's that is documented. And then the ones that we categorize as unexpected adverse events are then reported up to the public health agency. And you can actually find the summary data, like Canada publishes data on adverse effects and it shows the categories and what vaccine they're associated with. And those are published, I think it's every week, those are published and updated. And of course, they're not published by jurisdiction, they're published as a national report. So we keep very close track, and it all helps us to understand the effects, what the possible adverse effects are. What this is showing us is that these vaccines are incredibly safe. These are the Moderna and the Pfizer vaccines, incredibly safe, and very well tolerated. We know, for instance, there are predictable effects such as people who feel really lousy after the second shot for the first day or two. That's quite common. People with feeling fatigue, you know, headache, just not really well. I felt that myself after the second shot for about a day. And we also know that there are known effects like a sore arm, swollen glands under the armpit sometimes, things like that. Sometimes a rash a week after the first dose on the arm. So there are these kind of known and mild and predictable and transient effects. And then there are the, you know, potential other effects that have been documented. So you'll see, for instance, that there's been reports from Canada, the US, the UK on heart inflammation around the heart as a rare event associated with young people, as particularly young people after second dose of Moderna or Pfizer vaccine, after the mRNA vaccines. Rare, mild, they get over it quickly, but it is one of those kind of effects that we've learned about as a potential side effect. When you weigh that against how well the vast majority of people do with this vaccine and how effective the vaccine is, there's no question that the benefits of the messenger RNA vaccines far outweigh the really tiny risks that are associated. You know, any vaccine carries a certain amount of risk, and it's usually in that really tiny category, you know, the 1 in 100,000, 1 in 500,000, 1 in 1,000,000 risk of something adverse, compared to the effect that we can actually get out of this pandemic with, you know, and get back to a normal life if enough of us get vaccinated.
Absolutely. I know that stressed the importance of getting vaccinated. And if your circle is unvaccinated, please encourage or have the conversation about getting information from a reliable source on vaccination. I know that UConn is leading the way with our vaccination rates and this wave now with the per capita infections. What insights are you sharing with your colleagues across Canada about what you're learning about this outbreak? And based on what we're learning here about reopening, Are you worried about the other provinces and territories as they proceed with reopening?
Yeah, this is a really important question. And yes, I have been sharing our experience. And I have done some national interviews. There was a very, very good interview this morning on local CBC radio, which some of you may have heard, with a well-known Canadian epidemiologist about the Yukon experience. I'd really recommend listening to that. But I think what this shows is that the variants will find unvaccinated people. And it sounds a bit scary, but that's the reality, that if we have unvaccinated people, especially when they're connected with each other so that the vaccine can spread, then you will see those effects. So we need to be prepared for that. And the way to prepare for that, again, is back to vaccination, and also assuring that you can anticipate the response that's required. So, for instance, we've seen that with 3/4 of our adults vaccinated, we have enough unvaccinated people that it can overwhelm, even temporarily, the healthcare system and the public health system. So we have to not only really, really work really, really hard at decreasing that pool of susceptible people by vaccination, but we also have to be prepared to have the ability to ramp up when required. Ultimately, we will have to live in an open society, but we have to do this again. We have to go back to that phased reopening. And we have to figure out where do we need the protections. So it's not, you know, let's do vaccination as well as we can. And then what else do we need to do in terms of where there is risk? What is the ongoing role of masking, for instance, in indoor gatherings, especially where people are unvaccinated? What is the ongoing role of for how we do school reopenings and how we organize that? And how do we maximize ventilation through the winter time in indoor spaces? So how do we use all of the tools that we've learned that are probably much smarter tools or more focused tools than just the lockdown? Because if we look probably 5 years ahead, I think we're going to be living with COVID and variants for the years to come. It's going to be throwing new challenges at us. And we have to figure this out. But we do have a number of tools, and vaccine, the most important one. But we have those other tools of being able to respond when we need to. And part of it is that ability to ramp up public health and healthcare capacity also when we need to. So there's a lot to learn. I think Canada and the world has a lot to learn from our current experience.
Mm-hmm. So that's all the questions that we have. I want to thank everybody for submitting questions and for taking the time, Dr. Hanley, to answer all these questions and continue. Really thank you for your continued patience and just your calm demeanor that keeps us all on an even keel. Very much appreciated. So I think parting last words, what do you want people to do to stay safe?
Well, thank you. And thank you for your kind words, Amethia. And, you know, it's been very helpful, I think, to use you and your team's skills in bringing those questions to the table, because we need to keep talking and we need to really help people. I hope that we can help to address some of the concerns and worries that people have. And, you know, why are we doing this and not this? And what are we thinking of next? These are really important conversations to have so that we can stay together in this response and we can live as well as we can while we do this. So I'm really happy to be able to do this from time to time. And I want people just to, yeah, stay calm, stay well. We've got lots going on, lots of challenges at the moment, but we are working our way through this and we're learning as we go.
Thank you. Safe 6+1. Wear a mask.
Take care.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
That's it. Bye.